Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna Patkiri, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Emily Contois and Jenya Keesh. Emily Contois is an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Tulsa. She holds a PhD in American Studies from Brown University, as well as an MLA in gastronomy from Boston University and an MPH in public health nutrition from the University of California, Berkeley. In addition to numerous articles, book chapters, and public essays, she is the author of Diners, Dudes, and Diets, How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture, published by the University of North Carolina Press, 2020. Jenya Keesh is an assistant professor of media studies and associate director of the Oklahoma Center of the Humanities at the University of Tulsa. Her work explores digital agriculture, food media, and philanthropy. She is a co-editor and contributor to a forthcoming special issue of New Media and Society on farm media, and also serves as an associate editor of the Journal of Cultural Economy. Currently, she is writing a book on the philanthropic-capitalist media culture. Emily Contois and Jenya Keesh are the co-editors of Food Instagram, Identity, Influence, and Negotiation, published by the University of Illinois Press in 2022. It is this very book that we will be discussing today. I'm very happy to have both of you here and welcome you to this discussion.
Thank you so much for having us.
Right.
Lovely to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So let's begin by talking a little bit about how the idea of the book came to you and, you know, what its scope is like.
Certainly. So an editor actually reached out to me. There isn't a book on food Instagram, Emily, and there should be. And as a junior faculty member, I was in the throes of, you know, writing and editing, you know, my first book, Diners, Dudes, and Diets. But I couldn't let it go. As we look to the landscape of digital food studies and where there's content and great writing about food, food Instagram still hadn't been covered. This book didn't exist and it needed to. And so when I reached out to mentors, they said, well, if you're going to take on an edited volume, you should take on a really fantastic co-editor. And so I was so lucky that Zenya and I were hired at the same time into a really forward-thinking department of media studies that thinks food studies is media studies and very warmly embraced this project as one that we took on together. And so we worked together on a CFP that we sent out into the world and got dozens and dozens of really fascinating abstracts as we thought about what could the landscape that we could lay out in this book look like. And so I think as I reflect, right, like we're so proud of our introductory chapter, which really charts this course, right, the history of our ideas of thinking about food visually, as well as thinking productively about the visual ecosystem that is Instagram, that an edited collection was actually the right output to really tackle this, that we could have done a very interesting co-authored book, but to do an edited collection that has 17 chapters from 22 contributors from all around the world telling really interesting case studies with different methodologies that represent 12 different countries. We could truly tackle the vastness, right, of what you could cover thinking about food Instagram, a topic that up until that point had been quite dismissed as a platform that was just about beautiful photos of food, that perhaps too much about leisure, about a sort of middle class or even affluent sense of luxury, one that was sort of feminized and had been dismissed as more sustained academic attention had turned to Twitter or Facebook as spaces for political conversations, for branding, for that idea of the public square that we continue to debate. And so part of what we wanted to recapture and claim and defend in this book is the significant contributions of Instagram to exactly those sorts of conversations as well. But I'll pass it to Zenia as she thinks about our work at the beginning of this project.
Yeah, I think one of the things that this book does so well, and it's really thanks to how widely our CFP traveled and all the work that we put into sort of reaching out to folks, you know, globally, that this book really has a very, very broad reach, and especially beyond Euro-American scholarship, which tends to be the dominant voices in the room when we're talking about digital media. A lot of media studies is very focused on those Euro-American frameworks and examples. And the same can be said, you know, perhaps to a lesser extent, but it is still plays in food studies. And so we really are able to draw out, you know, voices and viewpoints, case studies beyond that, simply the global norm. And to think about how these media and food transformations and trends travel, how they are picked up, how they're used in many different spaces by many different, differently positioned subjects. So we have case studies in aesthetic and economic and political uses of food across the platform. We really go beyond those the things you first think of when you say food media. So we definitely discuss a lot of the expected images of food pornography and the kinds of typical, desirable, highly commercial, advertised foods and food cultures and the sort of fitness and diet cultures that are associated with Instagram. We treat those and we place them into conversation with many other less expected case studies. And so that's one of the things that makes this book so interesting. And we also present a lovely range of comparative case studies, and also the way that food media migrates between contexts, whether that's geographical, historical, or generic across different digital and media genres. So, for instance, how are the food media ecologies of Thailand and Australia linked through social media celebrity and transmedia production of food of food content? How is it that we can look at the political contexts in Brazil and Italy and think about the rise of the political right and how social media, and in particular the use of food imagery, is integral to developing certain kinds of political subjectivity and public reach. And so that kind of transnational scope really offers rich methodological and content-driven diversity across the book.
Right. So you do talk about bringing together an edited collection with diverse methodological approaches to study of food, specifically on the social media platform Instagram. So if I wanted to ask you that, you know, could you comment on some of the methods that, you know, the authors have used in looking at food and Instagram, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. So one of the methods that we pushed everyone was visual analysis, that we were very pleased that University of Illinois Press could support us with a grant from our university to be able to publish all of the images in color. And so in every chapter, there aren't just illustrations, there are really beautiful images that the authors are pushed, right? That we, with every round of review, working with everyone to think more deeply about what the images were doing, what is the interplay between the visual and the textual, as we lean to the tools of close reading, of deep reading, of thick description, that there are very interdisciplinary approaches. There's history, there's, feminist approaches, thinking about power all throughout the platform, perspectives from literature. We have one chapter on health food influencers that had a slightly larger data set and was looking at, you know, all of the posts and doing sort of a more coded content analysis there. So those are a few that come to mind. What are you thinking of, Zenia, when we reflect on the methodological influence of the book?
It's really a rich collection, and that's what makes each chapter so fun to read, because each chapter offers a different case study, but also a somewhat original or different approach. And so as digital ethnography is expanding as a kind of maybe a bucket list method, there are a lot of things that you can bring to studying digital content. We have, as Emily mentioned, the historical. We have analysis, quantitative analysis of large data sets. So some of our authors are considering things like the use of hashtags in a particular place. Like, what does the hashtag food porn, what does it do in France, for instance, on the French internet? How does it function in different capacities, and how does it attach to different kinds of images? What is the meaning of food visuality that it instantiates and demarcates? But we also, we have authors who do things like different kinds of ethnographic and interview-driven approaches. So we have a couple of authors who toured around biscuit restaurants in the U.S. South and spent a lot of time not only engaging with the visual feeds of these biscuit restaurants, but in the spaces, walking through the cities and the neighborhoods, walking through the restaurant districts, spending time exploring, like, what is the design and layout of the restaurant themselves, and how is that conducive to or designed for a particular kind of digital visuality that's easy to snap and post on your feed. And then the food itself, how is food something that you actually have to physically, materially engage with while also studying its visual representation. So we have a whole range of authors who spend time in restaurants and in kitchens and in the places where food originates. So on farms, in fields, at farmers markets, thinking about, okay, what are all the spaces of food production and how does that translate into these emerging digital forms of visual representation. We have a little bit of political economy in there. So some of our authors also look to what does labor look like across the food visual value chain? So what are the different kinds of work that do appear on our screens in digital media, and those that maybe are more shunted to the shadows or hidden or deliberately sort of left out of the frame? So what's the work of preparing food, of growing it, of transporting it, of editing the content and moderating the content that keeps our feeds sort of full of the kinds of images that the platforms want us to see, but also protects us from those that they don't want us to see? And a lot of these different methods really come together in interesting ways to ask questions that kind of are interdisciplinary in their scope. So from the direction of ethnography, but also content analysis, but also quantitative analysis, our authors are collectively asking, what is the content we want to define as we identify it as our subject of study? So it's an interesting methodological question to even ask, what is the food image on Instagram? Is it just what literally the photographic frame within the post? How does it interact with the text around it? How do feeds as a whole produce galleries, produce time spans, produce narratives across time and also as they migrate to different platforms? So our authors are really asking methodologically, how do we identify, how do we frame, and how do we track and follow these complex digital media productions? And so in that way, methodologically, we're opening up, I think, a lot of interesting questions about keeping up with these digital media that turn over and change so quickly, and that also offer new features that will arrive and stay for a while, like IGTV, Instagram TV, which was current and relevant to some of our authors. They were studying some of the television production that was being done, and that's since been dropped by Instagram. It didn't really take off in the way that they were hoping it would to compete with other video platforms like TikTok. And so some of our authors have had to figure out, okay, well, how do we capture that moment in time and tell that story in a way that's relevant to, you know, different features as they come along, like stories and other things in this constantly changing digital environment.
Right. So if I ask you, what does the book exactly bring to Instagram or digital media studies, what would you tell me, you know, in terms of maybe something new to the theoretical framework or methodological approaches?
I'll toss that one to Zinya.
Yeah, that's a great question. Digital media studies is, of course, rightly focused on the relationships between technologies and people. How is society impacted by, how does it contribute to new technologies, and what are the impacts as they get introduced and as they change? So, you know, a lot of digital studies is already thinking, digital media studies is already thinking about the technological features and design of platforms, the structure of technology industries, and a lot of interesting work on the content of our digital media, questions of speech, privacy, ownership, identity, digital content and advertising, the attention economy, different forms of engagement. And so we engage with all of those questions across the book, but we also draw out and bring into sharper focus certain dimensions of digital media and Instagram in particular that don't get perhaps as much attention as they really warrant. So things like the importance of embodiment and affect, the place of bodies in interacting with our digital media platforms, that's something that is front and center whenever we talk about food, food cultures, and consumption. We can't not think about embodiment and our physical material engagement with the food as well as with the media that we're using to depict, sell, hide, or otherwise engage with food. And so this helps us to think about gender, for instance, through questions of embodiment, affect, emotion, memory, those sorts of things. But we do that beyond, including and beyond some of the ways that are conventionally associated with food cultures and digital food cultures. So we do have content on diet and health influencers and fitness and those sorts of things, for instance. But we also bring in and expand discussions of political masculinity and nation branding through the kind of unexpected register of food media, right? Those are not conversations that generally come together in digital media studies. We also have a lot of work that expands and thinks about food porn in transgressive ways, in ways that think about the excess and the boundary pushing of what is the beautiful or the delicious or the forms of consumption that we want to indulge in, and where's the line of where it goes too far, right? So those are interesting aesthetic questions that are brought forward through our book as well, and really kind of expand the scope of digital media studies. And then really, as mentioned before, the kind of transnational comparative examples and case studies really bring Instagram into a global conversation, which is often not given as much light as it should be in our digital media studies, which tends to think about these dominant platforms from the perspective of American or global North users. So those are a few of the ways that I think we're really bringing the conversation of Instagram into new directions in digital media studies.
Right. So what do you think does the book also bring to conversations on food studies?
So I think our claim is that this book opens up a rich invitation between food studies and media studies and shows what's possible when we engage the theories, the perspectives, the methods from both fields to get to a much richer place. So one way that we do that in our introduction is thinking about this language that's been a part of sort of food activism, of farm to fork to waste, thinking about a food system, thinking about it as a series of networked nodes, right? A bit more complicated than just a simple supply chain. And so we apply that metaphor, that system, to Instagram itself, to think about how it produces a rich and complicated and sometimes contradictory visual food ecosystem by bringing that network analysis to thinking about how these images of food circulate, produce meaning, and are a significant part of driving our food system. I think as part of that analysis, we got to this rich place of realizing and being able to argue that Instagram isn't just about representation. It's not just these beautiful images of food that have aesthetic conventions of representing a food world, perhaps more beautiful than it actually is as a sort of dominant way of seeing, but that visuality, that process of representation is producing the food system that we have, whether it's driving the way farmers want to represent their labor and their final products, the way that food influencers show us cooking and their various food processes, that this idea of the frictionless food fantasy that we get to consume as we scroll through these images, that there's always, right, more complex stories about power, about access, about inclusion and exclusion that these images are showing us. And then I think similarly to our question, thinking about, you know, the visual analysis as one of the key methodologies, is also this focus on the gastronomic, on the sensuality of food, of having these be chapters, some written by media studies scholars, where we encouraged every author to think about ingredients and flavors and preparation techniques and what things look on the plate, how they taste, how they are part of histories and heritages, that these are all sort of typical foundational food studies insights, to never forget the materiality and the sensuality of food, and that even as it is circulating in a digital space, in these digital ways, that we're able to have a book that captures sort of all of that feeling and all of that meaning when it comes to food.
So how do you see the platform contributing to new food trends, and particularly the creation of new food ideas designed for the camera more than for taste buds?
So we chuckle a little bit that we finally, right, published this great book on food Instagram and the social conversation, right, and the platforms our students are especially using have moved on to TikTok, where there is a similar but also different, right, sort of food media culture circulating. But I think one of the things we're proud of is that the book thinks about this much longer trajectory of food porn and thinking about the aesthetic style that was created, you know, in food cinema, on food television, in glossy food magazines, that really takes root in the food blogosphere in the early 2000s, and then of course explodes and proliferates when it comes to food Instagram. That this world of incredibly beautiful, seductive images aligns with this concept of Instagrammability, right? Images worthy of being captured and shared on the platform. And so we write in the book about the shift to sort of anti-food porn of at first young audiences and then of course, other users as well, resisting those norms that came to be hegemonic, right, of what food porn, Instagrammability, beautiful food looked like, to be able to create different kinds of food imagery and different food possibilities. And so we see TikTok very much within that trajectory, that it's just this continuation of being able to create food content and increasingly maybe ways that feel more authentic, more amateur compared to the auteur, more everyday than the commercial aesthetics that Instagram had sort of codified. So we find that lineage really interesting. But I know Xenia and I, we've talked about this a lot. I know she has other ideas here too.
Yeah. I think that Emily's really drawn out why it's so important to always think about Instagram as part of a bigger media ecology, that it's a platform that exists in relationship with all of these other media, you know, platforms, and therefore different styles of communication. So as much as TikTok has a different food aesthetic, it arises because of Instagram's dominant way of representing, you know, a particular ideal of how food should look. So I think that that's something that, you know, that's still Instagram relevant. And so I think that's very helpful. But, you know, food Instagram is really thinking about what are the large-scale impacts and kind of expectations put on our food industries as much as individual users and consumers. So how is it that restaurants have really reshaped themselves through a very high engagement with Instagram? As we point out in the book, you know, between 2010 and and to the end of that decade, 2020, a vast majority of U.S. restaurants had a presence on Instagram as one of their places where they market and draw in audiences and consumers. Like something like 90%, you know, had regularly updated Instagram accounts, and that's really, really key to their marketability. And so that therefore changes what that restaurant looks like and how it conveys it, how it communicates what a kind of place it is, not only the food that it has, but why you want to come there for the experience of food in that space. So lighting, decor, wallpaper design, the kinds of visuality of the outdoor walls and all of the photo opportunities that come with eating at a place have contributed to reshaping our food culture. So that includes what's on the menu, right? So a couple of our authors contributing an analysis from France, they talk about traveling around Europe and asking in a few different instances for a dessert menu and the recommendations of the waiter. And the waiter would say, and they heard many times the waiter say, well, you know, this is perhaps the most delicious dish, but this is the most Instagrammable or the one that's most beautiful, right? And so those kinds of expectations that people are looking for something that is as visually appealing as it is tasty, those are shifting the boundaries to an extent of what constitutes food in the post-Instagram era. So quite a number of our authors really think about what are the foods that are invented with that camera lens in mind. So one of our chapters looks at the creation of the unicorn latte, which was initially a drink created by a small Brooklyn cafe, just one little place, independently owned cafe that created this very visually appealing drink using all kinds of, you know, powders and different ingredients to make it look very colorful and beautiful. And so they advertised it on their Instagram and in their social media. And that very quickly became a place of contestation with Starbucks, which created its own unicorn frappuccino that was widely publicized and was people sort of put it under the same category or started calling it a unicorn latte. And so it led to actually a legal battle over IP, who gets to own this very, very visually attractive drink that many people sort of said, well, it doesn't even taste that good, but look at how well it photographs. And so that's just one example of many. Another chapter looks at the development of freak shakes in an Australasian cafe chain, Cafe Patisserie, which are, you know, up to 1,500 calories, these monstrously huge creations with many, many layers and lots of syrups and cake layers and ice cream and all kinds of things going into them that many patrons would buy them to photograph and not even to eat because they were more than, you know, a single meal's worth of nutrients right there, or calories at least. And so there are all kinds of ways in which the visual expectations are shifting food cultures. And that is that continues to be relevant even as other platforms are developing different food aesthetics.
Continuing our conversation on food aesthetics, what would be some of the less discussed or surprising ways that power structures shape this content and aesthetics of food Instagram?
So I think two examples that I think of immediately, we have one chapter thinking about the long history of feminist restaurants communicating with the communities that dine with them and thinking about what's similar and what's different from the more analog world of cookbooks and newsletters, calendars, right? Other, you know, paper goods that would be passed out, mailed out, a part of the restaurant versus the work that's done on Instagram. And one of the points that Alex Ketchum raises in her chapter is the significant extra digital labor that Instagram requires of constantly producing content and of an emotional labor in developing a following, responding to comments, responding to problems, you know, interacting with all of your followers in your community. That it actually places a fair amount of time and energy and affective emotional expectations upon these business owners as they use Instagram as the way that they market their businesses and connect with their consumers. So I think that's one way of thinking about how the expectations of Instagrammability and beautiful images puts quite a lot of pressure on all restaurants of all types to be able to sort of reach that expected standard of how we represent food on the platform. And then another one that comes to mind, right? Like sometimes we think of, you know, this more negative or spaces within food Instagram that are ripe for critique. But another chapter that comes to us from Robin Caldwell looks at how the space of food Instagram and hashtags like Black Girl Cooking were ways to be able to sustain community, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic when we couldn't cook together, be in actual physical community together because of the distance physically between us, but to still maintain that community through recipes, through food, through particular ingredients or particular dishes that had significant meaning. And then also the hashtag, right? Be able to cultivate that between users. And so thinking about whether those photos are of beautiful food or of beautiful sort of community building, not just during the pandemic, but also thinking about the, you know, global, you know, sort of racial reckonings following the murder of George Floyd, of thinking about the incredible possibilities of Instagram for community building that I think, you know, when we think about the subtitle of the book, right, identity, right, of using Instagram as a space to be able to communicate one's own identity, but also to create those affective bonds among social groups, to create influence. And then also this last, you know, sort of section with negotiation of the various ways that users and communities are able to deploy Instagram, to use, manipulate, reimagine Instagram against even, you know, what the platform and its affordances and its business propositions would necessarily invite us to use. So those are a couple of examples as we think about where aesthetics and power meet and took us to very surprising places. I think I can't help but share one more. I know Xenia and I both really love Jocelyn Anderson's chapter on farmers who are not just talking about how they use Instagram to connect with consumers at the farmers market or to join CSAs, you know, with beautiful bucolic images of farms. But the idea of the farmer dark gram, these private accounts where they are in, you know, much smaller networks of farmers facing similar challenges, to be able to use Instagram as a space to build community, to get help, to get support when your crops fail or, you know, some small disaster or large disaster happens that you don't want to sort of share with the consumers who might not understand, you know, all of the ins and outs of sort of agrarian life. And so that's a really interesting example to think about how these farmers, you know, have multiple accounts, one where they're, you know, broadcasting a particular bucolic imagery that's a part of marketing and a part of an imaginary of global life, of agrarian production, of farming and farmers and knowing where your food comes from in this sort of commercialized and almost romanticized sense. And then the real world of farming and agriculture and the challenges that that brings.
Mm-hmm. So how important are transnational linkages in both the production as well as distribution of food and digital media?
So central. And this is
again important. I'll let Zinni jump in though. I know she has tons of great things to say here.
Yeah, these as we discussed, I mean, this is why we developed our very original and interesting framework for thinking about digital food media through the feed supply chain. So in terms of thinking about the transnational linkages and frameworks for understanding both food media and food industries and digital media specifically, and then all the places where they intersect, this is precisely why we developed the framework that we did of the digital food, digital media feed chain. I'm sorry, I screwed that up. Let me start over. Now I'm a little bit thrown. Okay. So this is a very interesting question, tracing the transnational linkages that comprise both our food industries and everything that goes into them and our digital media as very much globalized cultural and economic institutions. And this is why we developed the framework that we did in the introduction for talking about these things, where we think about the digital feed supply chain and the fact that there is no way to isolate a single food product nor any aspect of digital media as strictly local or as strictly a national product. All of the examples that we look at are in some way, you know, transnationally embedded. And that's not necessarily in production. Some of our chapters look at very, very local forms of production. So some of our farm chapters, for instance, as mentioned, the local, very local communities formed on the farmer dark gram. But also we have a chapter that looks at happy meat producers, as defined by our author in Australia, who are using very locally based narratives about raising animals in ethical and very environmentally friendly ways on their farms in order to counter ideas about all meat as sort of industrially factory produced and deeply cruel systems. And so we have many, many people telling very local stories about food on Instagram, but these things end up circulating, you know, much beyond local or national borders. And so that's one of the ways that we always have to think about how distribution affects the geography of food Instagram. But there's also underlying Instagram as a platform. There are all sorts of transnational labor that go into keeping the feeds full. So everything from content moderators to the engineers to the transnational cable systems that maintain the internet. All of these layered global geographies are intrinsic to keeping food Instagram going. So as much as globalization is a cultural and economic transformation that brings us together through these increasing flows and forms of interdependence, we see at the level of representation and cultural production, we see these efforts to sort of therefore reinscribe local and national identities. So within this very interdependent and transnational economy that we're in, how is it that social media platforms open opportunities for really defining this is here, this is now, this is me, or this is my community, or this is my food, or this is how we identify as through forms of like home traditional cooking in Italy or in Denmark or in Brazil? Those are a lot of the questions that we explore. And so it really digs into that tension between a global political economy of digital media and then very locally rooted food cultures, which nevertheless are part of broad global food networks.
So let me ask you a different question. What would be some of the themes from the book that you aren't usually asked about?
I'll say I think some of the things that we've thought about since doing this book is thinking about the pace of academic publishing and the interesting mismatch with how very quickly digital media changes, evolves, responds to changes within its ecosystem. As you know, one platform changes, others follow. That thinking about sort of digital publishing innovations, right, as we think about how we as academics cover these topics at the pace at which these industries are innovating and changing. But then similarly, a slower story of thinking about how Instagram is also a part of creating an archive as we think about what stories will be able to be told about our contemporary, you know, digital food media moment as we look to the historians of the future and the vast array of content they'll have to pull from as we think about grid images and stories and highlights and reels, right? Sort of copying TikTok and, you know, whatever else comes next, particularly as Meta's business model and success or not, you know, continues to fluctuate. That I think that interesting tension between the past, present, and future of these apps, how we study them, how we capture them, how we understand the meaning that they are making with consumers in industry, how they're shaping our broader sort of food media moment, are things that we're continuing to think about for sure.
I another thing that really strikes me, especially as we've been talking about the book for many months since it's come out, with many in conversation with many of our contributors as well, is the deep self-reflexivity that pervades all of the work that went into the book and that continues to constitute us as social media users. So, for instance, we have a couple of contributions that are, we call them our sort of more applied chapters. One is about the use of Instagram in the classroom. Right, and food Instagram in particular as a very vital mode of teaching and having students think through and engage through their senses, right, and think about how to digitally engage with all of the other embodied affective sensory experiences that go along with food culture. So Sarah Tracy writes about different experiences teaching food media in different college level classrooms, and the kinds of experimental approaches that she and her students take to sort of charting, recording, ethnographically engaging with the meaning of food and food as media. And then we also have a fabulous chapter from Casey Highsmith, who really embodies that self-reflexivity and makes it explicit in her chapter by writing about what it means to both, in her case, be a food influencer on Instagram. She had a very huge following as a food stylist and baker and maker and food photographer. And she also is doing a PhD in American studies, where she is studying a lot of the cultures of Instagram. And so she is able to talk across those roles that many of us inhabit, but don't necessarily think through each other. So we, you know, Emily and I have social media presences, and perhaps because we study this, we're a little more attentive to it than the average person. But we're all both consumers and makers of content to varying degrees. We all, for instance, we all cook food at some level, we all consume food, and it often overlaps with our social media usage. And so that kind of self-reflexivity, we tried to capture that and draw it out in our different contributions in the book. And it's really captured in the cover of the book, which was a collective effort between Casey Highsmith, one of our writers, Emily and I, where we talked about like what is the image that really speaks to everything going on in this book. And so Casey made the cake and then stylized through ongoing conversations with us what the presentation would look like. And so we have many different layered elements there that we have on the cover. It's a cake of an iPhone with a food Instagram image on it. So we've got a cake image on the cake itself. And we've got other elements, you know, of that interactivity and self-reflexivity depicted. So we've got a knife that's cut a piece of this cake out, really shattering any illusion that it's just pure image, right? We see the insides of the cake exposed to view. And we see some of the tools used both to make the cake and then also to deconstruct it, to make it consumable and critically available to us. And we see all the different things that go into making, you know, an interactive food media experience. We see, there's a little bowl of hearts, right, that are the likes that go into fueling that attention economy, but that also fuel the food economy in many ways. They're both attention economies that overlap very significantly and increasingly so in the digital era. So all of those things sort of speak to the kind of self-reflexivity that is a submerged theme across the book that I'm always keen to talk about given any opportunity. So thank you for that question.
Thank you. Last question. What would be some of the things that you're working on now or maybe in the near future?
So I'm working in the early stages on a new book called Like an Athlete, looking at how that idea of elite athletic performance has taken root all throughout American consumer culture post-1970, not just how we're supposed to sort of work out and dress out like athletes, but also eat and hydrate and recover and think and perform and be like athletes in all areas of our life as a way to critique sort of a cultural neoliberalism that has taken root at exactly the same time. I'm also just finishing up an open access textbook chapter in ad text about gender and advertising, thinking about how femininities, masculinities, and non-binary identities are being represented in historic and contemporary advertising, and where we need to go to have a more just and joyful sort of advertising marketplace, what industry structures are continuing to be in place when it comes to gender. And then lastly, I wrote a more personal essay, sort of combining history and a little bit of memoir and experience, of thinking about this tension when it comes to cooking, something that has always been this tension of like labor and leisure, a domestic drudgery and a specific kind of creative expression, right? Elements that definitely came out as we were editing the Food Instagram book as well. And thinking about how in my own life, that tension became buried when it came to things like academic burnout and, you know, pushing out so many publications so quickly as we make that fight to tenure of sort of where our food lives sort of lie within that. So those are two pieces coming out soon, and then a book, you know, far in the future, but things I'm very happy to be working on.
So in the realm of food media relevant work, I'm developing several new projects on farm media, which is my real fascination and what brings me to all of this. So I'm just wrapping up editing a special journal issue that looks at farm media, that proposes the concept, the idea of farm media as a really vital analytic lens for thinking about the transformations of the farm right now through all of our digital technologies that are creating the smart farm, for everything from Wi-Fi enabled tractors to embedded sensors to the digitization of the vast food supply chain through blockchain and other kinds of digital platforms. So I'm thinking about what is farming and or what is communication, what are media to the farm, and also how has the farm always informed our media, our communication and media industry. So the very term broadcast, right, is deeply embedded in the history of public media. And yet that is originally an agricultural term. And so when we look at the long history of both media communication and farming, they're actually much more interlinked than scholars in either realm usually think about. So we're trying to build a new conversation for what media studies and agricultural critical farm studies can bring to each other. So I'm very excited about that. And that includes looking at some of the new food and agricultural technologies that Silicon Valley is developing right now and what it means to bring venture capital-backed innovation into the realm of food and agriculture. How does it change what a farmer does and what a farm is and where a farm exists, right? What does it mean to move into vertical farm or to move food production from a cow, for instance, from full animals into lab-based cellular reproduction of parts of the animal, so the cellular reproduction of meat or milk and other things like that. So so that is one area of scholarship that I'm moving forward. Another piece that I'm working on right now is looking at the role of the tractor in Russia's invasion of Ukraine and how Ukrainian farmers and use both their equipment and their wiles to challenge the imperial occupation of Ukraine right now, and also the impacts that that's having on the global food system by interrupting some major global supply of grains, fertilizer, and other agricultural inputs that come out of both Ukraine and Russia through the Black Sea corridor. So I'm very interested in the intersections of food security and farming and conflict right now. And then I'm also writing a book on philanthropic media cultures.
Right. Of course, everything sounds very interesting, and I wish both of you all the good luck and hope to reading more of your work in the near future. On that note, thank you so much for this conversation. It was lovely speaking to you on your book, and I hope more of our listeners are able to read and enjoy the book after this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.